It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, apps like Uber and Airbnb offer services for cheap originally to bring in customers, but don't get used to those deals. Prices are going up as they try to bring in profits. Our guest says a lot of people may be in for some sticker shock. First, Republicans in the state Senate last week passed bills that would set rules for placement of drop boxes for absentee ballots, require photos for people with disabilities who vote absentee, and create more steps for some people to vote by mail. Those bills are expected to get a veto from Governor Evers. In other voting-related news, some Republican state lawmakers traveled to Arizona over the weekend to observe a third-party recount of that state's ballots from the presidential election. And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has hired investigators to look into how the November election was conducted here in Wisconsin. You can let us know what you think about all of this at 800-642-1234. Do you think the legislature should be finding ways to limit and clarify laws regarding ballot drop boxes and voter ID? How do you feel about outside investigators being hired to look at the 2020 election? Do you worry that these are solutions in search of a problem, or are there places where you think state laws need tightening up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Barry Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Well, I just listed a bunch of stuff going on, Barry. Let's start with these election bills passed last week by the state Senate. Again, likely it sounds like to be vetoed by the governor. That said, what are some of the changes that you have your eye on there?
Well, these bills are mostly focused on aspects of absentee voting, voting by mail in various ways, and sort of continue a through line of concern that Donald Trump and some other Republican officials had expressed before the election and then came out in lawsuits that were filed after the election. Now some of that has made its way into legislation. What would the bills do, as far as we can tell? They would do things like prevent the Elections Commission from mailing out absentee ballot request forms unsolicited. They would separate the form for requesting an absentee ballot from the envelope in which it's returned. Some communities had been integrating those into one sort of document and envelope together. They would require voters to submit a copy of their ID in every election in which they want to vote absentee, rather than providing it to their clerk once and then using that repeatedly. They'd make some changes to the so-called indefinitely confined exception, where voters who had an illness or disability or something else that kept them at home could request an absentee ballot without an ID, and some changes to how people living in nursing homes or other facilities would get absentees. And then there's also a change happening to the use of drop boxes, limiting the number of those that a municipality can use to collect absentee ballots. So almost all of this is focused on getting and returning ballots by mail.
How much of this is a response to a weird year for elections with the pandemic? A lot more people making the call to not go to a public site with lots of people and vote absentee. Some communities providing these drop boxes that aren't really, under current law, aren't really laid out how they're supposed to work. Is some of this just, hey, we had a big weird year and we're having to clarify some changes here?
Well, I'd say that's all it is in a way. It's completely a response to 2020. None of these bills were being circulated before the election or were things that were, you know, being debated in the legislature for multiple years. It's all a kind of reaction to that. I wouldn't say these are technical fixes to the law. I'd say they're really addressing concerns that Republicans in particular had about the election. Their concern that absentee voting wasn't secure, that it was being exploited. There were other irregularities that have bothered them. And I think that's what's led to the investigation that Speaker Voss has initiated. The Legislative Audit Bureau has been charged with producing a report on the election as well. So there are multiple tracks happening at once to deal with those concerns about absentee ballots.
With all that concern, do we have any indication that people who shouldn't have been able to vote in Wisconsin voted, or that fraud was committed under these circumstances? Did things go in ways that are just wrong, where it could have affected an outcome, say?
Well, no election is perfect. Election officials will tell you that. It's a complicated decentralized, very human process to collect, in this past election, about 3.3 million ballots from voters across the state. And I think it was a successful election by almost all accounts. High turnout, a smooth election despite all of the concerns about the pandemic, people's lives being disrupted, allegations about the election. So things went quite well. The Elections Commission has identified a couple of dozen potentially fraudulent cases that need to be examined. These have not been proven to be fraudulent, but they are ones that raise some questions. I think about half of those cases dealt with one UPS store in La Crosse where a number of people had been registered to vote. They, at least some of them apparently, are snowbirds who are living out of Wisconsin part of the year. We're getting their mail there. So it might technically be a violation of the law, but probably not fraud. I think what's important to keep in mind is that the things that are being focused on by state legislators are not likely to do much about these odd cases that may or may not be fraud. Something like an ex-felon, someone with a felony on their record, voting even though they're not yet off papers is technically a violation of the law. Those happen in every election, usually just because of misunderstanding of the law by the voter and by the poll worker often. But the kinds of things that are being floated in terms of legislation don't really address these cases that the Elections Commission has identified.
Talking to Barry Burden from UW-Madison, director of the Elections Research Center there, on voting here in Wisconsin. Some laws on their bills on their way through the state legislature. Also, a lot of changes going on around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make by moves of Republicans in many states, including Wisconsin, to change voting laws after the 2020 elections? Are there changes you think need to be made? Are there changes that have you worried? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Barry, there's concern that some of the changes we're seeing in states around the country will deter valid votes, will make it harder for people to cast votes that they should have been able to cast. Looking at these changes in the works in Wisconsin, do you see that, again, if these passed and were signed by the governor, do you see that as a possibility?
I think it's a real possibility, especially for some classes or some types of voters. Voters with disabilities in particular, and disability advocacy groups have raised concerns. Those voters rely really heavily on absentee voting. Many of them have mobility limitations, which mean that they can't get out easily. They have difficulty getting a witness on a ballot. Some of them do not drive, so they don't have a driver's license or other ID that would meet the voter ID requirement. Some of them are in facilities where they need assistance from the staff to get the ballot and sign their names and do all the things that have to happen to get the ballot back in. And these restrictions are really going to pinch those voters, I think, and will make it much more challenging for voters with disabilities in particular. But it will also affect anyone who used some of the practices in 2020 that will now be under tighter scrutiny. So many voters used those handy drop boxes for the first time. And they will, if these pieces of legislation make it through the governor's veto, they will not be as prevalent. And in most municipalities, there will only be one available for voters. So it will disrupt some of the practices that voters have gotten accustomed to and have worked for them.
I want to turn toward Arizona. Now, in that state's largest county, state Senate Republicans there have this procedure going on, a recount by an outside company, and a lot of Republicans around the country going there to check it out, maybe borrow the idea, including this weekend a handful of Republican state lawmakers from Wisconsin. What are you seeing in this Arizona, whatever we're going to call this procedure they're doing there?
Yeah, I'm going to call the procedure a review of the election. It's disputed whether we can call it an audit or a recount, though the groups involved, these private companies who have gotten state funds and are raising private funds, are counting ballots for sure, and they're reviewing them under microscopes and with special cameras, and they're doing other kinds of document analysis, getting near the end of that process. They are hoping that their effort in Maricopa County will inspire legislators and others in Wisconsin and Georgia and Pennsylvania, some really key swing states, to pick up the gauntlet and do something similar. Now, I'll just point out in Wisconsin, we actually did recount all of the ballots in Milwaukee County and Dane County, but that didn't stop That hasn't stopped the movement in Georgia, where there were actually two statewide recounts, and in Maricopa County, where there was not a full county recount, but there were two audits of machines and one random recount of selected boxes of ballots. So, you know, for folks who just have ongoing suspicion and do not trust authorities and don't believe the testing and auditing and other things they've already had access to, this is sort of the last recourse for them to get verification that something was wrong with the election.
Observers have raised a lot of concerns with this review. People with pens where they shouldn't have them. A company that the owner that's running this, Cyber Ninjas, the owner had signed on to some conspiracy theories about the election. Do you have concerns about the way this review is being done?
I have so many concerns. It's not following any of the standard protocols. It does not have the kind of transparency you would want. Observers are generally not given access up close to see what's going on, which is very different from the kind of recounts we're used to, where there are journalists and observers up close watching what's happening. The equipment that is being used there to scan the ballots and photograph the ballots, none of it is certified voting equipment that has been tested and approved by the state. All election officials know that they should only be using scanners and tabulators and other machinery that has been tested and certified. The private company that's overseeing this, Cyber Ninjas, really has no experience in this field and appears to have a kind of partisan favorite in the game. So I think there are a lot of concerns, even simple things like the handling of the ballots. They are apparently inspecting the paper to look at the thickness of the paper, the quality of the paper. There's some suspicion that a Chinese government may have submitted some ballots on a different kind of paper, but they're living and working in an environment where it's now over 100 degrees in Arizona. They're in an air-conditioned arena, but for a week, those 2 million ballots were moved out of the arena, put in a different building that had so-called swamp coolers operating, which actually humidify the air, and then brought back out into the desert sun and then back into the air-conditioned arena. So those ballots have been through a lot since November, and I fear that some of the irregularities they identify will just be from handling and mishandling those ballots.
Talking to Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center, looking at new voting-related bills in the state legislature and calls to review November's election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see state lawmakers pursue bills that will limit how you can drop off an absentee ballot or create more stringent voter ID requirements, especially for indefinitely confined voters? If they pass the legislature, do you want to see Governor Evers veto those bills? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation. Get to your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Barry Burden, UW-Madison political science professor and director of the Elections Research Center, looking at some of the latest news on elections and voting laws in Wisconsin. You can join in with your thoughts and or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Menominee. Steve, hello.
Hi, I just got a question about voter suppression. Knowing that far more Democrats turned out for the election in this past election cycle and voted absentee and mail-in ballots, and it seems like this might be a Republican effort to suppress that vote by limiting that ability to vote in that way. I'm just wondering what your guests might have to say about that idea. Thank you for your call.
Steve, thanks for calling in. Barry, what do you think?
Well, I think it does reinforce suspicions among Republican legislators in particular, at least some of them, that Democrats took such advantage of voting absentee and used it so heavily. And Donald Trump lost the election in so many of these key swing states like Wisconsin that there must have been some shenanigans or irregularities. And everyone has heard a story, it seems, or an anecdote about something that was suspicious. So unfortunately, I think it's just fueled that distrust of the system further than would have happened otherwise.
Thanks for that call. And I've seen concerns, Barry, on and off from Republican strategists before and since the election, worried that if their voters keep hearing these messages, their voters, Republican voters, are going to avoid voting absentee, and maybe some of them don't end up voting at all. Do you see it as a concern that it might backfire for Republicans, at least in some states?
Yeah, it might well backfire if this were an intentional effort by some lawmakers to try to advantage their party and disadvantage the Democrats. It might do just the opposite for a couple of reasons. One is that before 2020, before the pandemic, Republicans were actually somewhat more likely to vote by mail or vote absentee than Democrats were across the country. They were just better at it. They were more regular voters and often older voters who preferred to vote by mail and were likely to return to some of the pre-pandemic patterns once this passes. So the 2022 or 2024 elections might look more like those than they look like 2020. The other is that the Republican Party has changed in its demographic makeup. There's a piece today in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel from Craig Gilbert reviewing data from the 2020 election in Wisconsin, and he shows that Republicans did really well among so-called low propensity voters, voters who are sort of intermittent, showing up in some elections and not others. So, and that's something new. That's really part of the Trump coalition that wasn't the case before Trump. So any efforts that make voting more challenging, make it more stringent, are likely to impact those low propensity voters more than regular voters who have a lot of experience and are sort of robustly taking part. And so it could actually hurt Republicans in a couple of different ways. So I think they should be careful if part of the effort is to advantage one party over the other.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Jeff now in Spring Green. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question on modernizing our voting system. So, you know, are we looking at maybe in the future being able to do this from our computer or from our phone? And obviously having the security and the safety there, so, you know, we're still protected, but, you know, a two-step verification of some sort. But, you know, having people to be able to vote through the technology that we have in the world today could potentially open up our voting all across Wisconsin, potentially the U.S., correct?
Jeff, thanks for the call. All digital voting potentially, Barry.
Well, I think we're still a ways from all digital voting, but there are a number of technological tools that have made voting easier. State of Wisconsin now has online voter registration. It's had that for a few years, so voters can go online to become registered or update their registration. Requesting an absentee ballot for most voters can be done online as well. So voters are at least making that request, and in some cases actually receiving the ballot electronically. The place that we draw the line at the moment is returning the ballot electronically. Except for a small number of military voters who may be on a submarine or out in the field someplace, they have an exception to return ballots electronically by fax or by some other means. But in terms of using an app or something like that, I think that's a few years off in Wisconsin. It is being experimented with in some other states for a small number, typically military voters, but it's just much more challenging than it would seem. It's more challenging than banking or doing taxes or using an ATM because of the anonymity of the ballot. Not being able to connect a ballot to any one person makes it much harder to develop a good technology like you would use, you know, for banking or some other application.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Nate now in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I want to mention two things. First, Officer Sandovic, who I think Robin Voss has put on the taxpayer dime, he may have misused his position as part of an investigation years ago to sort of play politics. Because way back when they were discussing expanding same-day registration at the federal level, and his police report or the report that he dropped out there basically was pro-voter ID and anti-same-day registration, even though in Wisconsin these days, if you register on Election Day, you use a voter ID. So he was not, I think, He was being too political with his position in a way that was misusing it. Also, as somebody who lives in an area where Dropbox is were used, including by me, and they can be monitored, I think it is an attempt to avoid honest elections because you don't want to have people be able to vote if you limit their Dropboxes. So I do not trust the efforts to do things like that.
Nate, thanks for the call. And very neat referring to a story we haven't gotten into yet. Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, Republican, hiring investigators to review some aspects of the November 2020 election. Nate referring to there was some reporting in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looking at an officer involved in that who had been accused of using, as Nate said, a partisan slant in past investigations. What are you looking at with that that investigation from the Assembly Speaker?
Well, that investigation seems troubling because it's a handpicked investigator whose preferences, as Speaker Voss admitted, lean in his direction. So I think he has a sense of what that group is likely to find. I think it's going to be a total of three investigators in the end. It's also overkill because it's happening on top of the hearings that are going on in the state legislature, on top of the audit that Speaker Voss ordered from the Legislative Audit Bureau. And the reports and work that the Wisconsin Elections Commission has been doing. So I don't think it's necessary. In fact, I don't think it's helpful. It's likely to be harmful, especially for the questions it may raise about the integrity of the system. I agree with Nate about drop boxes. The legislature seems okay with drop boxes existing. So I don't understand why one is secure or two are secure, but five would not be. They can be monitored by camera. They can be emptied each day, just the way a U.S. Postal Service box, those blue boxes we all know and love, would be used. That also is a confusing matter.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute, Barry, what are you watching for next when it comes to voting laws in Wisconsin?
Well, I will be curious exactly what the Republicans produce. There are some disagreements, particularly in the Senate, among a couple of key Republicans, including the chair of the committee that oversees election legislation. But so far, Republicans have been able to move the bills despite some opposition from within the party. I will be watching to see if there's anything that Governor Evers thinks is worth signing into law or whether he will veto the whole package of things that comes his way. That seems to be his preference. And what happens in other states like ours, where there are Democratic governors and Republican legislators and battleground elections, places like Michigan and Pennsylvania. This is a nationwide effort that's happening to make changes to elections.
Barry, thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be here.
Barry Burden is professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center. He joined us for a look at voting bills that passed the state Senate last week and an investigation into the 2020 election being called for by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Now the price of an Uber or Lyft ride is about 40% higher than it was a year ago. Having food delivered, staying in an Airbnb, renting a scooter to get across town, expect to pay more for these app-based services than you did in the past. A lot of these apps, it turns out, offered low rates, bankrolled by Silicon Valley investors. Our guest is here to explain the economic method behind those discounts and tell us why the era of cheap rides may be coming to a close. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use any of these app services, the Ubers or Lyfts or Airbnbs or DoorDash? Have you noticed price changes? Have you taken advantage of deals? Do you work for one of these services? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kevin Roos is a technology columnist for the New York Times. His recent piece is titled Farewell, Millennial Lifestyle Subsidy. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Kevin, let's talk about the business strategy of a lot of these companies initially. The big plan was, if I'm reading you right, lose money, lose lots of it to attract customers. How did that work?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but not much. This strategy is called blitzscaling in tech lingo. And what it basically means is if you are a company that's trying to disrupt an existing market like taxis or hotels or meal delivery, something like that, what you want to do is you want to raise millions of dollars in venture capital from investors. You want to get big as fast as possible in a couple markets, maybe San Francisco or New York or Los Angeles. And the way that you want to get big is by making your products and services artificially cheap. So if you are running Uber and you want a lot of people to take Uber instead of a taxi, you just make the Ubers cheaper than a taxi, even if it means losing money on every ride. You do the same thing in meal delivery or hotels, and you grow your business that way. And then once you've sort of elbowed out all the competitors and become a dominant market player, then you can start raising prices again. And this has worked for a number of companies like Uber and Airbnb. But for a lot of companies, they never are able to actually flip that switch. They just keep losing money. And eventually they go out of business. And this is what we saw happen to MoviePass last year. And I think this is, you know, one aspect of this is that for a number of years, millennials, people like me in these big urban markets, could take advantage of these really luxury services at a non-luxury price, at a pretty reasonable price. And it kind of allowed us to live beyond our means in a way.
Yeah, the headline is, like I said, farewell, millennial lifestyle subsidy. And that's sort of a joking, not joking description of how these things function for millennials. Could you talk about that lifestyle subsidy a little?
Yeah, well, this is a little tongue-in-cheek. And I, to be clear, I don't blame millennials, myself included, for taking advantage of these deals. But I do think it points to just how odd this past decade in the economy has been. I did some math on one of these scooter startups, you know, that they put these rental scooters all over the country in the last couple of years. And there was one company, Bird, that was losing $9.66 for every $10 it made. So that's in addition to the $10 that it's not making, it's also losing an additional $9.66 on every transaction of $10. So that is the kind of subsidy we're talking about, where it's literally the consumer is paying half the price that it costs to provide the service. And so for obvious reasons, a lot of those companies have had to transition. They've had to start jacking up their prices. They've gone out of business because they just can't keep losing money like that forever.
Now, Kevin, this may shock you, but I am not a big money Silicon Valley investor. But if I was, would I really have the patience to watch a business earn or lose more than it's earning at that kind of rate? Are investors saying, yeah, this is a good long-term gamble?
Some of them are. Yeah, there's been a little bit of a turnaround in that. But I think it's important to remember that this is all part of the investor's plan. They want these companies to lose a lot of money very quickly and establish themselves as dominant market forces. And that has worked really, really well. The investors, early investors in Uber, have made a lot of money on those investments because the valuation of the company kept going up even as it was losing more and more money. So the problem is that once you take these companies public, once they're being traded on the stock market, public investors don't have the same risk appetite as venture capitalists. They aren't okay subsidizing billions of dollars in free, you know, or very cheap Uber rides for people. And so these companies, once they turn public, have had to show more profits, which has resulted in these subsidies shrinking.
Talking to Kevin Roos, technology columnist for the New York Times, looking at a lot of these app-based service providers, Uber and Lyft and Airbnb and the scooters and the meal delivery services. Prices going up as they try to turn the corner and make money. Do you rely on these apps, any of these services we've mentioned or others? Have you seen prices going up over the last year? Do you work at one of these? What's it like for you? Do you feel like you're getting fair return on your work? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kevin, let's take this now to the consumers. What kind of price changes are they seeing here? Is it sticker shock, or is it more subtle than that?
Well, sometimes it's sticker shock. I think, you know, as you mentioned, the price of an Uber and a Lyft ride has gone up about 40% in the past year. And that's in part because of these subsidies going away, and in part just because there's a real driver shortage. Airbnb prices have also increased about 35% in the first quarter of this year compared with the year before. So There are some instances of sticker shock. There are also some instances where these companies have just ceased to exist. They went out of business. For example, there were a number of companies several years ago that were doing laundry delivery in big cities. You could use an app and they would come pick up your laundry and do it for you and then bring it back. And it was very, very cheap, sometimes cheaper than actually going to a laundromat yourself. And they burned through millions of dollars and eventually they all went out of business. So that's also sometimes the way that this ends.
As these prices go up now, are people going to be looking at, oh, those taxi companies, that's still there. Oh, and that hotel, that's still there. And all of a sudden, maybe it looks like a good deal compared to these price increases. How much concern is there about that from these app companies as their prices go up?
Yeah, well, I think they're at a big risk of that. I mean, I quoted one person in my story who was talking about, you know, who's going to continue to pay $500 to stay in an Airbnb for 2 days when you can pay $300 to stay in a hotel that has a pool and room service and cleans your room every day. So I do think that's a risk. I think for Uber and Lyft, it's less of a risk because frankly, there aren't that many cabs left. A lot of them have, you know, turned into Ubers and Lyfts. So I don't think there's too much danger of people going back to yellow cabs.
Yeah, and how much of it is, okay, if the person's gone to the trouble of putting, say, the Uber or Lyft app on their phone or enrolling in Airbnb and having that app, that force of habit now is going to keep them coming back, maybe more than brand loyalty even.
Absolutely. We've all become habituated to these on-demand services because, in part, they were artificially cheap. And so we built our sort of lifestyles around them. And not everyone did, obviously, but I'm speaking, you know, as a person who also did this. I took advantage of a lot of these deals. And it's hard to quit once you've gotten in the habit of getting your, you know, your dinner delivered for, you know, a nominal fee. When that fee suddenly goes up to $10 or $12 or $15, all of a sudden it's like, maybe I should cook for myself.
Talking to Kevin Roos, technology columnist at the New York Times. He's telling us why prices for a lot of app services like Uber, Airbnb, and Grubhub are on the rise. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in the so-called gig economy or sharing economy as a driver delivery person? Say, do you rent out Airbnb? Are you seeing things change from your perspective? Flip it around. If you're a customer of these things, are you in the habit of using them? You're going to stick with it, even if the price is going up, which it is lately. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farad. Right now, we're picking up our talk with New York Times technology columnist Kevin Roos. The price of a rideshare, a meal delivery, or vacation rental may be on the rise, has been on the rise in many cases, as Silicon Valley hopes to start turning a profit on these app services. They spent years basically doing loss leaders to get people signed up to download the app. Now they want to do something like make money. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use any of these services around your hometown or when you travel with Uber, say, or Airbnb? Do you work for one of these? What are you seeing when it comes to the prices? Will you stick with it even if the price goes up? Or are you looking to go back to taxis or hotels when you need those kind of services? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear your experiences. Now, Kevin, we're not hearing people's experiences right now. And I wonder how big a difference is there in like the big cities. You mentioned the San Franciscos and New Yorks of the world versus maybe not as much penetration into the Midwest without your huge cities.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the points I make in the article is that these services, these prices, these strategies of blitz scaling, they were very concentrated among sort of a young, affluent consumer base in cities like New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles. Those were sort of the markets that these companies tested in before they rolled their services out to the rest of the country. So if you can remember, maybe, you know, in its early first couple of years, Uber was only available in San Francisco and a few other cities, and it then expanded all over the country. So the strategy often is lose a bunch of money in the big cities, test your service, see if people actually want it, and then if it turns out that there's appetite for it, then you know, spend a bunch more money to expand all over the rest of the country and maybe internationally too.
And Kevin, I dimly remember that there was a good long stretch of time where Amazon was getting bigger and bigger, but not actually turning profits. And it seems like they're doing okay. Is that the blueprint for a lot of this kind of strategy?
Well, sort of. I mean, Amazon famously did not make a profit for the first many years of its existence until just a couple of years ago. It had never made a quarterly profit. And so that's the playbook that a lot of these companies are saying is we'll just get as big as Amazon by losing money and then we'll turn a profit all of a sudden. But Amazon, it's important to remember, didn't didn't lose money because it was selling, you know, $4 worth of toilet paper for $2.50. It was not losing money on individual transactions that made it unprofitable. It was that they were taking the profits from their business and reinvesting it into their business. I think the difference with a lot of these sort of startups that are sort of the Ubers for different industries is that they're actually losing money every time someone uses their service.
I wanted to ask about the employees and just, oh, we've got to actually speaking of users, let's go to Scott now in Duluth. Scott, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Scott?
Oh, in reference to the Airbnb prices, I'm a travel nurse. And so for the last 3 years, I've been doing Airbnb. It's been the cost effective way for me to do my job. And I've noticed in this last year, the prices have gone up so much that I, first of all, what is offered out there is limited. There's not nearly as much as a few years ago. And what is out there, the prices have gone up so much that I converted a van into a mobile little home. And my most recent job here in Duluth, I'm staying in different spots and sleeping in a van and still actively looking for places, Craigslist, Airbnb, but, you know, have resorted to staying in hotels and in my van. So that's my story.
Interesting, Scott. Thank you so much for sharing that. So Kevin, high prices driving people into hotels or in this case, a van.
Absolutely. And you know, it's important to remember, it's not just that these subsidies are going away, right? We also have for Airbnb, I mean, maybe fewer people are listing their houses on the platform because, you know, they're not excited about during a pandemic having people in their spare rooms who they don't know. There are other reasons that prices are rising for various things. But in the past, these companies and their billions of dollars in venture capital would have sort of made that shock less. They would have eased that burden on consumers by sort of giving more sort of discounts and things like that to sort of coax people onto the platform. But the problem a lot of these platforms have now is very different. They have too many customers. They have too many people who want to book Airbnbs and Ubers, and so they're having to kind of work on generating more supply.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Kevin, let's talk about the labor side of things. You mentioned not enough Uber drivers in a lot of communities. We hear talk about maybe wages going up in general in the economy, some places having trouble hiring people. How much is that affecting the apps that we're talking about here?
Yeah, I think the worker shortage that's being felt in lots of sectors is also affecting the gig economy. Uber, for example, has started a driver stimulus program. So instead of subsidizing customers, they're now giving additional money to drivers to try to lure people back onto the platform. And, you know, there are reasons that people might not want to drive an Uber when there's a pandemic going around, and the idea of having strangers, you know, getting into your car all day may not be the most appealing thing. But I think that, you know, the labor shortage is real, and it's something that I think a lot of these companies are feeling.
We're talking to Kevin Roos, technology columnist for the New York Times, looking at what might be the end of an era, the era of cheap app-based services, prices on things like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, DoorDash going up in many places around the country. And you could join in if you have an experience to share at 800-642-1234. Kevin, in your piece on this, you look at the scooter company you mentioned earlier, a Bird. They used to be losing lots of money on each rental. What has changed now in those communities that have these scooters?
Well, the first thing is they've jacked up the prices. The price of a scooter used to be something like 15 cents a mile or a minute. I'm sorry, 15 cents a minute. And now it's something more like 40 cents a minute in some markets. So they've more than doubled the price of a scooter rental. But they've also made certain improvements in, you know, getting more durable scooters that don't have to be replaced as often and sort of making other parts of their business more efficient. But the main one is just that they've jacked up prices. And so they're making a profit on every ride instead of losing, you know, $9.66 on every $10 ride. So that makes a big difference.
Now, we're mostly talking here, Kevin, about companies that have been around for some years. Now they're household names in a lot of places or close to. Do you see new companies emerging with this strategy, the blitz scaling strategy, or is this kind of old hat now? I don't know.
Well, this has become a big part of the tech playbook. I mean, most Silicon Valley venture-funded startups use some version of this playbook. They want to get big first and then worry about making money later. And so you see this all over the place. I think the most interesting one right now is there are a bunch of these sort of 10-minute delivery apps that will deliver you a soda in 10 minutes or less from a local convenience store. And that just seems totally unsustainable to me unless you're charging, $25 for the soda or something.
Huh. Now you, in the piece and on the air, you've mentioned, Kevin, you are a big user of these discounted service. Does, for you personally, does the convenience of the app and the service continue to justify using them even with the price? Or are you yourself starting to look at alternatives to some of the things you used to use?
Oh, absolutely. I've been forced to seek out alternatives to a lot of the stuff I used to do. But a lot of it is just, behavioral change. So, I used to get more meals delivered, and then when the price is raised, now I cook more meals for myself. Or I used to, use an app to book rides, and now I'll drive myself, or I'll bike, or I'll walk for short trips. So I think a lot of that is sort of just unlearning the automatic behaviors that we learned over the past decade or so. And to a certain extent, maybe that's healthy. Maybe we shouldn't. Maybe it should be a rare luxury to have, a private driver or to get your meal delivered. Maybe that shouldn't be as cheap as it has been.
As we look ahead for these big name companies that are on a lot of people's phones now, how long is it going to take us, do you think, to know if these price increases are going to hurt their business, if they're going to live through all of this?
Well, I think, price increases in these apps, maybe getting better as sort of the economy recovers from the pandemic and people start opening back up their spare rooms and, get more comfortable driving people around, we might see some of the prices fall a little bit. But I think we're all just going to have to do a little bit of reassessing of sort of what our habits are. And I think especially those of us in big cities where these services were a dime a dozen, we just have to recalibrate our budgets and our expectations of what we can and can't afford.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kevin Roos is a technology columnist for The New York Times. We talked to him about his recent piece on Uber and Airbnb and a lot of these other app-based services that people in some communities have come to count on. Prices are going up now as they try to turn from a large-scale business, even if they lose money, to actually making money. Still time to hear from you. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Are you seeing these price changes if you're somebody who is planning to travel and maybe use the Airbnb, or if you use Uber in your town or when you go on the road somewhere? Are you seeing these prices go up? And if you work at one of these companies, how's this affecting you? Tweet us at Central Time WPR.